So my sentence after house arrest for 2.5 years was 4 years, but so I did a year in. I reframed this whole situation in my head. Number one, I told my mom I was just going to camp. So I was like, Mom, don't worry, I'll be okay. I saw it as an investment. I was like, okay, if I'm going to spend all this, I'm not going to see it as something that's going to continue to ruin me. It's going to be something that's going to make me better. And so I saw it as an opportunity to educate myself. What I do in there, I read 82 books. I also saw it as an opportunity to get off like the drug. Like I wasn't like a heavy drug user, but I needed to get away from it. The other thing I saw was like kind of like a sabbatical, just as a chance to get away and like kind of reflect on your life. And so it was all those things. I was like, rehab's 50 grand a month. So I'm going for a year. So I'm getting a deal here.
Welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. If you've ever felt like you should be doing something more with your life by now and you're running out of time to do it, you're in the right place. I talk to ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and I leave you with two or three specific changes that you can make to start living a bigger life right now. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation with Emily O'Brien. Emily is the founder of Comeback Snacks, a gourmet popcorn company she started while in federal prison for drug smuggling. And honestly, if that's not enough to get you to listen, I give up. Emily is honest, raw, and vulnerable, and she puts a lot of things in perspective. And maybe if she can launch a comeback after everything she's been through, maybe we should stop bitching and get on with that comeback of our own. Please enjoy Emily O'Brien. All right. Welcome, Emily, to the show. I can't tell you how excited I am about this.
All right. Well, me too. Here we are on this wonderful afternoon.
Yes. So I'm going to spring something on you, and it's a bit of an experiment, and I hope you're okay with that. I know you've been on a ton of podcasts. You've told your story. It's an incredibly inspiring, amazing story. We're going to talk about all that. So what I would normally do is say, okay, let's start at the beginning. Let's talk about your childhood and leading up to your conviction in prison and starting the company and all those things. And we'll do all those things. But I thought about what would Quentin Tarantino do? Because his movies always start with some big cinematic moment at the beginning to draw people in. And then it goes back and he takes us up to everything that led up to that moment. And then we move on from there. So we'll see how this works. If your life was a Quentin Tarantino movie, what would be that defining cinematic moment that the movie would open with?
I think it would honestly be when I was let out into the courtroom for the very first time and my parents were there looking horrified and I was shackled head to toe. I wouldn't even say it was getting arrested at the airport because I didn't really realize how serious it was. I thought I could just go home. But like, I think the most serious thing was that moment and just seeing the horror on their face. Like, they just wanted to make sure I was okay. I mean, they're definitely pissed off. But I think first and foremost, as parents, they were glad that I was okay.
What was it about that moment that stands out above all the other crazy moments and things that happened to you?
Because I looked at my mom and she looked like she was almost going to pass out. Like she like looked so scared. And then I couldn't even look at my dad. So that definitely tells you. I don't even think they knew how to act. So they just let their bodies respond to what was happening.
I can't imagine. I mean, I do have kids and I nothing in my life has prepared me for seeing my, you know, son or daughter go through that. And I'm sure it was probably like for them too. Like they had tried to prepare themselves for it, but it's just one of those things that's so surreal that you can't imagine it ever happening to you. It's just something that happens to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you realize like you both have different memories of things, right? Like when I was talking to him earlier, it's like, I kind of didn't think that he would think like that. And then I'm sure I said things or he didn't think I would think a certain way. Right. And, you know, one of the things he said was like, you know, no one ever wants to see their daughter like in jail. And like, that was a very poignant moment for him, I guess. I guess for him, it was when they came to visit me at the jail for the first time. And they were like, you know, we'd heard about prison and what it was like, but that is nowhere you ever want to see your child.
Yeah. Oh my God. I have so many questions. And by the way, like I imagine like most people, everything I know about even the criminal justice system, but also prison is TV and movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure as you're telling this story, and even as you're talking about your parents going through it and you're going through it, like, all we're doing is trying to imagine what this world is that we've seen on screen. And then some of it's the same and some of it's completely different. And it's all, you know, fairly horrifying.
Yeah. And it's also different to each person's experience as well.
Yeah. Okay. So take me out. Let's talk a little bit about what led up to that, because this is the scaffolding. This is the, you know, the bones of the story that you've told many times. But if you go back, like, what was your relationship with your parents like, you know, growing up?
It was great. They were great parents. My dad was my basketball coach. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. Like, I had no reason to go to prison. Like, what people would think, normally no reason. Like, well, your life was perfect. And then just goes to show, like, doesn't matter how great you can have it around you, you can still find yourself in trouble. And my good friend, Jordana Goldlist, she's a lawyer. And she's like, everyone is literally one night away from having to call a criminal lawyer. And that's what the lessons that she's learned. Everyone, doesn't matter who you are. She's like, I get so many calls from people that are like, I never thought I'd have to be making this call. And like, I guess that was my family's as well. You know, they never thought they'd have to call a criminal lawyer. So I went to high school. High school was fine. I graduated honor roll. Like, I went to the University of Guelph, where I always had jobs. You know, but I balanced it out with like a lot of partying too. So I was like some angel that stayed inside all the time. No, like, I was pretty wild. I graduated from University of Guelph with honors, and I went to Indonesia. I worked for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So you would think, okay, like, you know, I literally always had jobs. I, like, even in school, I always wanted to have my own job so I could afford my own lifestyle and ultimately go out any night I wanted to, because it was fun. But there's things that happened in our lives. Like, you know, my parents got divorced, but I also was kind of always... So I was sad about that, but I was also hanging out like with people in Toronto that were like, I don't want to say sketchy, but definitely like dicey.
Okay. So it's dicey and then sketchy above that somewhere.
Yeah. Like, so it was people that were like successful, but they all like did illegal things. Anyway, so I kind of found myself there. And then I, you know, became pretty heavily involved in alcohol. And alcohol, I was kind of always a drinker, but like, I would say the cocaine problem really started when I was living in Toronto, and it kind of became just a part of, I don't want to say everyday life because I'd probably be dead by now, but weekly for sure. I call it Botox for the soul, because I was definitely drinking it. And like, I had a business at the time, a social media company at the time, but so it was very easy to, like, I was doing events, I was doing like restaurants, bars, like all these things that made it very easy to just like blend in, because that was just like a normal thing, like drinking and sometimes even drug use, right? So it was very easy to hide that, like, I wasn't really doing it for fun. When I got to a certain point, it became, you know, this, yeah, Botox for the soul. And then I met who ended up being my co-accused. And where do we go from here? I don't know. Where do you want me to stop?
Well, okay, a couple of questions about that. Yeah. I think part of what has got to resonate about your story, and you've mentioned it, is, I mean, I don't really know what, I don't know. I hope you don't take offense with like the term drug mule or whatever, no. But you don't look like what I would imagine a drug mule to look like. You're a beautiful young woman. You're university educated. You have every privilege in the world. You have your whole life ahead of you. When you talk about your lawyer friend saying we're all just one decision or one shit luck thing happening from needing a criminal lawyer, there are a dozen things I've done in my life that I could have gone just slightly different, or things I've done and just never get caught doing. And I love to party. I don't know. The only reason I didn't do cocaine is because I had never seen it, but I never turned down anything that was put in front of me during that. So again, it's like, yeah, I can see how it starts off easy. It escalates a little bit. There's some other factors happening in your life that you're not, you know, you're struggling to cope with. Yeah. I can see that happening to me or lots of my friends. It's also kind of what makes, you know, movies like, you know, Shawshank, right? Andy Dufresne was like a mild-mannered accountant. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Lots of layers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so you graduate from university. So you meet your co-accused and you go on a trip, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd known him for about like 8 or 10 months. Like, it wasn't a new friendship. And like, you'll read some articles that say he was my boyfriend. Like, he wasn't my boyfriend. He was someone that I really liked spending time with because he was allegedly sober. And like, that's kind of the path that I wanted to be on, because I knew that I wasn't in a good place. We weren't like dating. Like, we, like, I think we hooked up once and it was like, that was it. Like, it wasn't some full blown crime of passion that some people think comes along with these relationships, right? That wasn't that at all. I met him through my work, and so he helped me with a lot of the simple things. He's like, let's go on this trip. And I was like, okay. But the thing was, like, he came over to my apartment like a week before, and like, that's when he asked me this really fucked up question. And he was like, oh, like, if you want, we can make some cash going down here, and like, we can bring drugs back. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, I was so mad. I was like, where does this even come from? Like, you're supposed to be sober. It was so out of left field that I was like, I kicked him out of the apartment. I was like, can you just like go? Cause like, I was honestly mad. I was so mad. And then he messaged me in there. He's like, I don't know what even came about like of that. Like, I'm so sorry. He's like, let's just go on this trip. Like, nothing will happen. And I like fucking believed him, cause I was so mad. And I was just like, what the fuck? Like, you know, maybe I should have been like, okay, this guy's sketch, but I didn't. Cause I just kind of replaced that event with all the good things that he'd done for me prior to that. You know, like all the very simple things that actually helped me get to my next day. And so I was like, I believed him, and I was looking forward to spending quality, like, sober time on like a week away. So I believed him.
Well, you want, yeah. And you also wanted to believe him, right? I'm sure there's lots of moments in this story where you look back and you say, wow, maybe that was a warning sign, or that was a warning sign. And you could drive yourself crazy with all the what ifs and feeling guilty about the decisions you made. But in the time, yeah, I can think a lot of people would be like, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So he's like, okay, send me your passport information. I'll book the tickets. And then he sent that passport information to people that he owed money to. And so we go to the airport, and he's like, okay, well, you told me we're going to Puerto Rico. And then I go to the airport and I look at my ticket. It says St. Lucia. And it's like, oh, like, I told you we were going to St. Lucia the whole time. It must have just been your drinking. And so I started to see his demeanor change as we got there. But I was like, you know what, I'm already here. Like, whatever. I blamed it on myself. I was like, you know what, I drink a lot. But then I actually looked at my messages after, like, and I realized he always fucking told me Puerto Rico. So, but anyway, I got on that plane. The first 3 days were completely fine. And then Wednesday came along.
And then what happened?
And then on the Wednesday, I'm about to go down to the pool in the afternoon, because I didn't like going in the morning because it's too hot. So I like kind of like the late afternoon. He's like, you're not going down to the pool today. Did you really think this trip was all fun and games? We're here to work. And I didn't really know what that work meant, but I kind of had an idea based on the event that happened at the apartment. But anyway, I still wasn't afraid at that point. Like, he's like, okay, again, like, you're getting in the car with me. Your friends are coming to pick us up. Our friends, like, using like little things in his verbiage that makes it seem like I've been in on this the whole time. But anyway, so we go to this place and it looks like a bed and breakfast. And I didn't even like really notice this, but he like had taken my passport out of the safe and then once we got to this house, he like just gives it to this lady. I don't know it's mine, right? Because it just looks like a passport. I don't know that's actually my passport. And so we go inside this house. So it's not like this big palace. Like, you know what you think like in movies, and you think it's like dogs are like, bah, bah, like drooling, and like, you know, guys are sitting there with these like guns and like the chains and bullets around their neck. Like, it wasn't like that at all. It was literally like a grandma's house, or like bed and breakfast, whatever. And then there's two other people there. She's like, thank you so much for doing this for me. And I was like, what? And so, and then he's like, oh, I'm so, so sorry. He's like, everything's gonna be fine. And I have to go into this room with this lady and get measured up. And that's when she told me, she's like, yeah, Ian said you're involved in this. And that's who paid for this trip. Like, they paid for this trip.
And so what, they tape like a couple of keys of coke to your body somewhere?
So it's like I'm going to like a tailor. It's like I'm getting this custom couture outfit. So I have to wear a bike shorts, and they're like, I call it Spanx for smugglers, because they have like a kangaroo pouch in the front and then one in the back. And then I have to go shopping with this lady and pretend to go pick out a dress that I want, like, that's supposed to disguise these drugs. So she's actually going to pick it, but I have to like go fake shopping with this. It was the weirdest experience of my life. I was like, what is happening? And anyway, so we pick out the dress. She knows my size now. And then they drop us back off at the hotel. And so that's when we find out on the Friday that, so she's going to sew this outfit And then, but they're not going to leave us with drugs. So they're going to pick us up on the Friday, take us back to the house, suit us up, and drop us off at the airport. That's how it went. Disaster.
And so you get, I mean, you go through security.
Yeah. Leaving was fine. That's what they told me. So they're like, you're going to be safe. This and that. There's no body scan. It was just a metal detector.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of, yeah, nightmare fuel. Like, at what point do you realize that this is not going to go the way you thought?
I didn't know. For the two days after that, he told me that he'd done it before. And like, that's when I actually believed him, because I had his ex-wife messaging me on Instagram, like, why does she even know I'm here? First of all, like, it was so weird. Like, all these factors that were coming into play, like saying, oh yeah. And then he's like, yeah, my ex-wife used to do it. Like, just trying to tell me that everything was going to be. And then he tried to get me excited about it. And I was like, this isn't exciting. So the 2 days before we left, I just got honestly wasted, like, by myself. I like left the resort. I went and like fucking sang karaoke at a bar by myself. So I was just like trying to make this last little bit of time go by as fast as I could.
And so you're sitting on the plane, you land, and how does the arrest happen, or how do you get caught?
Yeah. So there was another thing that he told me when I was like in this state of peril, cause I just wanted to go home. And that was when he's like, okay. Like, I'll take it off. Like, you can wear it, take it off when we get to Pearson and put in your backpack, and then I'll take it through customs. Cause I was like, I'm going to be a terrible liar. Like, but I just honestly want to go home. Like, I didn't know these people. And so I was like, okay. Like, can I just take it off when we get there and you can carry it through customs? And he said, yes. But when we landed at Pearson, I went to go to the bathroom. He's like, oh no, it's too late now. So he bait and switched me again. And so that's when I was just like, you can tell my body. Like, I was, I think that's what they also observed on the cameras, was like, something's really wrong here. Cause like, you could see the discomfort and the like almost anger, I think it was. And I was walking behind him. I didn't like want to talk to him. And so he goes up to the checkpoint, and then they tell you, like, I was like, I had no coaching. I was like, who am I today? Like, your friend, your girl, like, what? I'm definitely not your fucking wife. So, like, like, and so just the fact that he was so underprepared for like anything, I'm just so glad that he was so bad at this. And I was so bad at it, because we got called into secondary and they separated us immediately. And after a series of questions, the last question they asked me was, you know, Miss O'Brien, do you have anything on you? Because we're going to do a search. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm not going to lie to a federal agent. This is obviously happening here. So I said, yes. And that wasn't ratting. Like, that was literally just telling the truth, because ratting would be me jumping the gun and saying this ahead of time. Like, that would be like, help me. I have this. That is dangerous. And that was what I wasn't going to do. But I also wasn't going to lie to a federal agent when they were going to search me anyway.
Did you think that through, like, when you're sitting on the plane for 2 or 3 hours, like, are you playing these scenario out? Like, if this happens, I'm going to do this. Or are you just making those decisions kind of on the spot?
I made them on the spot. I was like, I think I was in this haze on the plane ride. I was wondering how my life had gotten to that point.
Right. So did they arrest you there and then take you into custody?
Yeah, I was arrested there. Then they tested the drugs, and then I was formally charged by the RCMP. And then that's when I had to go to the jail for the weekend. And it was the Monday when I had my bail hearing, where I saw my parents for the first time. Shackles galore.
Okay. So we're back to the first scene. Yeah, shackles seems a little excessive.
And like a chain, like hand to foot.
And so that is that, are you pleading guilty at that point?
No.
You know, it's funny, Emily, when I think back about all these movies and TV shows that we've all seen, they all have the same scenes in them. They have the scene that you described, where you're marched out into the courtroom and you see your friends and family for the first time. They have the sentencing. They have the first night where the bars close behind you. And I, as I'm thinking about this, I'm like, yes, because those are the moments that scare the shit out of all of us. Like, those are the worst thing we can imagine. And that's why it's sort of a part of every prison story we've ever heard. I just can't imagine what that's like. So are you sentenced at that same time, or is sentencing happened differently?
No, because I had to go to court, right? Because I wasn't guilty yet. Like, I was arrested and I was charged, but we had to go through like the judicial, like the justice system. And so I was on house arrest while that all was happening. So that was, I would say, the worst time for me, because that's when you really realize how deep of a hole you got yourself in. But the thing is, about this hole, you can't talk about it, and no one even knows that you're in it. because you're not allowed to talk about the case. So it was a very like dark and scary time. I think I was very, very depressed for the first year. I was very angry. I drank a lot, honestly. Like, I continued to drink because I was like, I can't do anything, right? Like, and I was just very mad and didn't want to take responsibility. I want to keep fighting these charges. And I also got arrested a second time because I really wanted to go out and get cigarettes. And I was like, just so mad. And I left the house to go get cigarettes. And I drove to the convenience store, and it was Frosh Week. So, because my mom lives in Westdale near McMaster University, so I was around Frosh Week, and so there's a lot of cops out, and they scanned my plates, and then they found out. So I was arrested in front of like a line, like there's a bar, and there's like 100 people in the line, and then I was like literally outside with a cigarette getting arrested in front of everyone. And then so I had to get bailed out again for $1,000, and that's when my lawyer was like, you know what, Emily, like we know that you're a good person, like look back on your life, we know that you are, but if you these rules, they're very strict. And if you just if you mess up one more time, we're not going to be able to prove this. So I think it was that. And also looking at all the old photos of our family, like from when I was younger and growing up, and realizing this is like what you have to fight for and who you need to fight for, because, you know, you put your family as victims in this case. They are innocent. And they've, you know, you've upended their lives. It was like that. I don't know if it was one day or 2 days, but that's when I was like, I'm going to use this rebelliousness for this fuel that I have for something good, instead of taking that negative energy. Cause like once you have like some sort of fiery energy, you can put it into really bad things, but you can also put it into something really good. And I was like, I know that I am this person. I'm not the one on paper.
Hey, it's Bob. And I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. You know, people listening to this story are going to be like, where did she get the strength, the resilience? You know, we'll talk about going to prison and, you know, starting the company and all the amazing things you've done since. But I think a lot of people look at that and go, I don't think I could be that strong. It's not like you get arrested by the airport. Like, yeah, fuck right. I'm going to use this as fuel to do make a real difference in the world. It was a long, dark, painful process.
I really realized that life is truly a gift, and I know I have so much good in me, and my family has raised us all to be good. And I'm so lucky to be, I'm actually lucky to be alive, you know? And so that was kind of, there was no other option. There was literally no other option.
Are there parts of the story that used to be really hard to talk about that have gotten easier?
Yeah, I would think my sister wouldn't talk to me for like 6 months. Every time I used to tell that story, I would like bawl. I would like sob hysterically.
Yeah. And that just took time and practice, I guess, in telling the story. And
time, practice, and healing, right? You know, and the more that you tell the story, the more people you meet that can always offer insight. And so the more other stories you hear by telling yours, the easier it gets.
So let's just finish off the prison. So you're in house arrest for how long?
2.5 years.
And so how long were you in jail?
I was in for a year. So the house arrest didn't count for my time served. So my sentence after house arrest for 2.5 years was 4 years. But so I did a year in. And that's like anyone that goes to prison for 4 years will get out after a year if they don't mess around. If you don't fuck around, you will get out after that time. That's just statistically, that is the number of days.
Yeah. And given that your perception of prison is much like mine and everybody else that's listening from TV and movies, how is it different than what you're expecting?
There's definitely violence. There's definitely things that happen unexpectedly. There's definitely rules that apply. Going to prison is like going to another country, except one that you just can't leave. You know, it's got its own currency, its own language, its own culture, its own borders, right? So I kind of just saw it as going to another country. But there are rules that have to be followed. There is a code. And if you have been convicted of a certain crime, you are going to have a really tough time in there. So crimes against children, if someone has ratted and still convicted, they're going to have a tough time in there. Like, all these things spread. So my sentence was drug smuggling. And so that's a very common charge. And I just pled guilty. So I had nothing to worry about. I ended up being like the accidental class clown. Because people were like, girl, what are you doing? Like, Lonnie, what are you doing in here? And so we... that was one of the things that helped me get through, was finding, you know, joy and humor in the most unlikely of places.
Well, and I'm sure you've heard the parallels to what's her name? Piper from Orange is the New Black. Like, there's right. It's just like, yeah, this pretty blonde girl in prison sticks out like a sore thumb and found a way to, you know, make friends. Did you have somebody that kind of took you under your wing in there?
There was one girl, her name was Sandra. She had been in there for like 10 years and she told me all these wild stories. I mean, they're not my stories to tell, but, you know, it was just learning all the different background stories of people that I've been in there and realizing, you know, like, everyone was suffering so much. Like, from, like, I was lucky because I grew up in a great household. I didn't grow up in a cycle of abuse or substance use in the family. You know what I mean? There's so many common themes as to why people get incarcerated. And, like, I was the odd one out.
What did you learn most from the people you met in there?
I think that we all want a comeback. I saw, like, love in everyone. I saw life in everyone, and I saw compassion in everyone there, which is like not what's usually thought of when you think of an inmate.
Right. And when you say you lived every day sort of with intention while you were there to try to make the best of it, what does that look like?
I reframed this whole situation in my head. Number one, I told my mom I was just going to camp. So I was like, Mom, don't worry, I'll be okay. But number two, I was like, okay, we're gonna spend all this money on legal fees. I hate wasting money, so I'm gonna spend that 50 grand on something. And because legal fees are exorbitant, like, they are so much, plus like all the travel fees going to the courts, like a lot of it's transportation for them to get back and forth from the court. 407 fees, I don't know. Got dinged for those. But where was I going with that? I saw it as an investment. I was like, okay, if I'm going to spend all this, I'm not going to see it as something that's going to continue to ruin me. It's going to be something that's going to make me better. And so I saw it as an opportunity to educate myself. What I do in there, I read 82 books. I also saw it as an opportunity to get off like the drug. Like, I wasn't like a heavy drug user, but I needed to get away from it. Like, I wasn't like an alleyway fucking doing cocaine, but I needed, like, it was something that I did every week, and I needed, and I knew that it had impacted my life in multiple more ways than one. So I needed to get off that and the booze. And then the other thing I saw was like kind of like a sabbatical, just as a chance to get away and like kind of reflect on your life. And so it was all those things. I was like, rehab's 50 grand a month. So I'm going for a year. So I'm getting a deal here.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, I get to kind of give myself my own MBA by reading all these books.
Yeah. One of the things I think about is this idea of reinvention. And yours is certainly a great example of that. And I want to talk about comeback snacks in a second. But I don't know. I think a lot of people are kind of looking at their lives and thinking, yeah, you know, maybe they're looking down the barrel of the last 20 or 30 years of their lives. And they're like, you know what? Things are going well. It's not a disaster. I don't want to blow my life up, but there's got to be something more. But they've only seen themselves or only done one thing for a while and they don't want to, this idea of fear. They don't want to fail. They don't want to be seen as failing, this fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. And yet you look at you, where you had basically every freedom stripped away, and it's easy to look at your life and go, God, like, if Emily can do it, surely I can get over my fear of what strangers on the internet will think of me, for example. But I'm wondering how you think about this idea of reinvention, because the truth is, this won't be the last time you do it. We're always sort of reinventing and changing ourselves.
We're always on the comeback.
Yeah, always on the comeback. Exactly.
I think for me, it's not reinventing myself, because I've always been a nice person and a good person and a good person with good intentions. I just got distracted and by the wrong incentives. I call it recalibration. You're just recalibrating. Like, you got a little compass, you know, sometimes you go this way. But I'm not, like, this whole new person inside. Like, I'm still Emily. Like, I'm still the fun little spunky Emily that I was, even when I was doing drugs and using substance, whatever, hanging with the wrong people, I still had that nice energy. So I just had the wrong kind of focus. And so that's why I call it recalibration.
Interesting. I do like that. I had never thought of it like that before. So how has this experience changed your, maybe your perception or your understanding of time? Because when I talk to people too, they're like, oh, I always wanted to do this. I always want to write a book or start a podcast or start a business. Oh, but I don't have time. I'll do it in a couple months. Things will settle down, and things never settle down. You never have enough time. You had all the time in the world. So I'm wondering what people could learn from that.
It was a true gift. And, you know, like, when am I ever going to get a chance to read 82 books in a year again? Like, reading was fun for me. I grew up in the library, and like, now reading is like a fucking discipline. You, like, you have to play and to read. And it's like, it's not as fun when you have to discipline yourself to do it. Right. I guess when it comes to time, I think there's no situation in life that can't be productive for you as long as you look through it through a certain lens. But if you're always playing like, oh, poor me, whatever, then you're going to collect that energy from other people, and things aren't going to go well. And yes, did I do that in the beginning? Absolutely. Did I live there forever? Absolutely not. You know, you can't just dwell in this emotional and mental anguish forever, because it's boring. It sucks. Like, what's the point? Right? Like, yes, I felt bad, and I had to fix things, but I couldn't live in that place forever, because I just love life so much. And I love seeing people happy and making people happy. And that place that I was in when I was on house arrest, like, wasn't me. And so I just got really freaking bored of it.
You're right. It is boring. Yeah. I've never thought of it like that. What a beautiful way to put it. Okay. So tell me about how you start a popcorn company. Cause I'm sorry, again, TV and movies, I thought you'd be making wine in your toilet. I didn't know that people could make food and popcorn.
Well, I went to prison. I said, no more sauce.
Oh, right.
I said, no more sauce. I had to be off the sauce.
Okay.
I was like, I'm not even going to have a fake cigarette in here. Cause people make something called tobacco, and they take tea and they smoke it. I was like, I'm not even having that. Like, no way. Like, I went in there with a very steadfast focus, and like, that was like, gonna get in here for a year. I literally planned, like, I was like, oh my god, I was looking forward to it, and like, you know, because I knew that I had the strength to make something really good out of it. So I didn't know what that was gonna be. And like, you know, my dad and I were talking about this earlier. It's one of the things he said was like, Emily, like, the way that our family has always raised you is like, you know, something good has to come out of this. Yeah. We don't know what it's gonna be, something good. And I knew that I was gonna share my story, because what's the point? And I also knew that I wasn't going to live a life where I couldn't share this story. I wasn't going to let that be another prison that I was stuck in of my own experience. So popcorn was a popular prison snack. And I talked to so many other people in there about like their stories and their lives. And what I like about popcorn is like, popcorn, it has to be in the right environment for it to pop. And each popcorn kernel is its own unique. It's like a snowflake. It's every single one is different. But if you put it under too much heat, it's going to burn. If you don't put it under any heat, it's not going to pop at all. So like, that's kind of like how people get involved in messed up situations. It's all their environment. And so that's kind of where the popcorn theme ties in. But like, we'd also put like different recipes on there. And then one day I was just like, why don't I start a popcorn company and I can employ people? Because I knew that I was going to start something. And I was reading books about social enterprises when I was in there, and just trying to getting ideas. And I was reading stories of other people that had became successful after incarceration. So I was collecting all this ammo. And I want to say, like, I was in prison at exactly the right time. I was in prison at the best time, because in 2018, prison reform was really starting to take hold in the United States. If this was in 2000, people would have given a shit. They're like, whatever, shut up, it's your time. But now people are starting to realize, okay, we need to actually help people when they're incarcerated and believe and support people. So there was kind of already this thought process that had evolved from people. So that's when I knew that I could launch this thing, this idea, and have some sort of social backing to it. And so that's how it started. Like, I played around with all the recipes. I sketched logo designs with my now business partner back and forth through snail mail. I got people to like print off food trends from the internet and send them in to me so I could like experiment with recipes. And I wrote letters to 82 of So I read 82 books, sorry. And I wrote letters to every single one. And yeah, I got letters back. Because, you know, if you send a letter from a prison, people are most likely going to open it.
Yeah, that's a letter I'd open.
Right? So that was like my little marketing hack. And that's how I began to build my mentorship network. And I also became very close with a lot of volunteers that were inside prison. I continued this those connections when I got out. And when I got out in early 2019, I worked at the gym because I had to have another job. And I worked, I think it was within like a year and a half. After working at the gym for a year and a half, I was able to go full time into which is now Comeback Snacks. So here we are. And I went over 1,100 stores across Canada. And I've hired like 12 or 13 individuals all at different times because some people come and use it as stepping stones for the next thing that have all been formerly incarcerated. So it's great.
It was funny when as I was doing reading up on you, I went to the website, I went to the store locator, and there's a store that's like two blocks from here that we shop at all the time. And then I'm like, oh, shit, I've had this stuff before. My wife bought a couple bags of it. It was just like the most decadent, delicious, you know, dark chocolate drizzled on caramel. And I was like, oh, my God, I had no idea that you were that girl from Comeback Snacks. I guess I should have turned the package over and read a little bit about the story and about the company.
That's okay.
It was just funny. I knew about you long before I heard about you from, you know, to have you on here. So it's absolutely incredible stuff. And yeah, 1,100 stores. That's huge. What's been the hardest part of that entrepreneurship journey for you?
I mean, I wouldn't say there's a hardest part. I would say there's hard days. And so knowing how to get through the hard days is the hardest part, if that makes sense. Because I knew going into it, like any like entrepreneurial venture, it's going to be hard. But now I have like the tools that I need to get through those challenging times. It's like I have the comeback toolkit. Because, you know, yeah. I did it inside prison. But from like a more practical thing, I would probably say working with the bigger retailers is challenging. Because they're so complex and they're so giant and right. They're so expensive. They have been great in terms of volume, but in terms of connecting with people there, it's very hard to kind of get someone that really works with you. And there's always things that are messed up financially, yeah. Like fees that are there that shouldn't be. So you spend a lot of time fighting for fees that you shouldn't have been charged and all this stuff. So I think that's the most challenging part.
What are a couple of the things in this comeback toolkit that you rely on?
I call it my comeback blueprint. So you got to commit, take ownership, have accountability, teach people, educate people, and have good morals. And that's kind of like all the steps that are involved in making a comeback. So you got to, number one, you have to commit to it. You have to take ownership. You have to take accountability. All these things. And then once you realize that those steps can be applied to any situation in life, like personal life, prison life, business life. You can use it anywhere.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. And I love the idea of creating a circle of mentors based on authors that you've written. Maybe it was a bit of an advantage to get to be able to send that from prison stationery to get people's attention. But that's something that anybody can do. And we always think, well, nobody's going to respond to me. And that's true. But shit, if you send 82 letters, you don't need 82 mentors. You need two or three good mentors, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So everybody at the company was previously incarcerated?
Not everybody, but so my business partner actually has his MBA from Ivy. So he's very well versed in finances because I'm in marketing, I'm in branding, I am in people. So you need to have both. So he's great with the operations. The people that I hire that are formerly incarcerated do everything from like in-field like sales and sampling to events. So I always have them out meeting people and trying to work with people in different cities as often as I can.
And talk to me about the work you're doing around reintegration. Because I honestly didn't know that was a thing. I had never heard of that term before. Maybe I should have. I don't know. What's that work about?
Number one is like hiring from within, but you, as you're a small company, you can't hire everyone. So I was like, what else can I do to kind of help people create more income for themselves when you have a criminal record? Because it's hard to get employment. Mm. So last year I got funding from North Pine. Me and my co-founder, Lucy Cullen, she like knows how to build programs like this. Like she's got the backbone strength, like all like the structural acumen to facilitate a good online program. And So it's all about how to start your own business with a criminal record and how to make your own money as an entrepreneur with a criminal record coming out of prison. So by the end of the year, we will have had 135 graduates coming out. So, because it's like number, like a very common reason. I don't know if it's number one, but a very common reason. It's either number one or maybe like substances. I'm not sure, but it's income. It's finances as to why people commit crime. So if you can teach people how to create their own income via entrepreneurship, you can actually be part of the solution. It's called Comeback Catalyst.
Oh, Comeback Catalyst. That's amazing. And so do you work with people that are already, that are still inside, that are, that have been released and want to start businesses, find jobs, all of that?
Yeah, so we work with both. We actually just developed a course for inside prison. And then outside, if people are on parole, they have to get it approved by the parole officer, because one of the rules is a non-association rule, and you can't actually be associated with people that have records. But some parole officers have been like, it's fine. So that's what we say. It's like, if you're on parole, it's your responsibility to disclose this. But yeah, we've gotten recommendations from Corrections Canada. I'm doing like talks in halfway houses, and then other people that are, have done their time. So it's quite a mix.
And what are you most excited about next, Emily, with Comeback? What's next for the company, your work around reintegration? What's that fuel got you targeted at next?
So I never think of the word as a next, because my dad told me one thing when I was very young, and it has resonated with me for a very long time. And he said, never wish your life away. I think it's because I really wanted this movie. I wanted to rent a movie when I was 13 or 12, and it was 14. When we were at like Jumbo Video, and I was like, I want to watch this. And he's like, no, you know, I was like, I wish I was 14. And then he said, Emily, just never wish your life away. And that has stuck with me. It's like, why do we spend so much time just waiting for what's next, as, instead of like living in this, in the moment? I'm like, I'm really proud for where we are right now. And that's why it's so important to be present as well. Cause then you can actually pay attention to the things that you created for a reason, instead of just being like, what, let's one and done, like next, you know what I mean? So I think next is not really something that I use very often in my vocabulary, but it's more now.
Okay. What now?
Yeah, like right now is our final cohort for the Comeback Catalyst we have over the year. And we're also in the middle of making a new flavor. We're also developing new sizes. So instead of having the one size, we want to get into more channels. So food service, more hotels, which are like every kind of industry has a different size. Like grocery is the main size, but then there's so many other ways that popcorn can be enjoyed in the world. Side, like sometimes we do like fundraisers or for events or whatever. So gas convenience, you can go to a variety store, you don't want a big bag, you want like a snack size. So developing different sizes, and yeah, just seeing all the cool businesses that our students are going to launch this fall.
Can you tell me what the new flavor is, or is that top secret?
I can't tell you yet.
Okay.
But it's with a very famous brand.
Oh, so intriguing. Love the secrecy.
I know, con code.
Yeah. Emily, there's just so much about this conversation that I love. I told you at the outset I was a bit nervous about this, because there were so many things I wanted to ask about, and just such an amazing, inspiring, powerful story. I know I'm going to leave here and wish I had asked another 20 things, but I've gotten a page of notes here about the things that you've said, and I'm going to reflect on them. And I just can't thank you enough. This has been just one of my favorite conversations ever.
Oh, thank you. So flattered. So nice. Oh, go Blue Jays.
Go Blue Jays. Well, that's the other thing. So by the time this comes out, the World Series will probably be over. I noticed on social that you were at one of the games, game one. Two against For the people listening to this, this will have happened like a month ago. So game one, when Vladdy hit the homer in the first inning, the place must have been
bonkers. It was shaking.
Yeah. Yes. And now big game three tonight, and game four if we need it, etc. Oh, no, game four tonight, game five if we need it. So when we listen back to this episode, what's your prediction about how far the Jays go, or whether they win at all?
I think they're gonna beat the Yankees, but I don't think they're gonna beat them tonight.
Yeah, I'm not feeling good about this bullpen night that they've sort of settled on, but I don't know.
But that's okay. If they have to make a comeback, it's okay, because that means I sell more popcorn, because we sell in that station.
Okay. Oh, right. Of course.
Rogers Center.
Well, Emily, I can't thank you enough for this. God, I really owe you one. This has been awesome.
Oh, thank you.
By the way, so I should ask you, for people that want to learn more about you, Come Back Snacks, where can they find them? Where can they find you? Where can they connect with you?
Yeah, LinkedIn, just look up Emily O'Brien. You'll find me there. Instagram at emz.obrien for my personal, and for the company socials on TikTok and Instagram is just at Come Back Snacks.
Yeah, and find the store locator at the website because this shit is fire. It's amazing.
So good it's criminal.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Jean-Michel Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.